At some point far in the future, historians will probably ask, what was daily life like in the early 21st century? Well, one thing we know for sure, nobody will ever point to these two clowns and say, this was how you should have been stacking Benjamins.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and happy National Spinach Day, everyone. Oh my God, Joe, we're doing Spinach Day now. Real spinach. Spinach Day. Spinach Day. Wow. Now that I think about it, and I think about all the ways that spinach has been a major factor in my life. Well, I'll get back to you when I come up with something. But hey, in better news, check out today's awesome show lineup. First, help us welcome, to celebrate Women's History Month, winner of the Bancroft Prize and author of the book Abigail Adams, Woody Holton. In headlines, we'll talk about this jittery stock market and talk social media with our Buzz correspondent, Jamie Wise. Then we'll throw out the Haven Lifeline, answer a lucky listener letter, and wash it all down with my incredible trivia. And now, two guys who are always green with spinach-fueled envy, Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
Well, not of Doug. Definitely not of Doug.
Spinach has grown on me in the years. Has it you as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, I could eat spinach all day now, but back in the Popeye days?
Oh, about eating it all day. But it is the long-lost cousin of iceberg lettuce.
It is. it's the spicier, juicier step-cousin. I don't know. Hey, everybody. I'm Joe Salci, I Average Joe Money on Twitter, and across the card table from me again for another week, it's the one and only OG.
The OG.
I am so happy that we're talking about Abigail Adams today before Women's History Month gets behind us, because I don't know if you know this, and Professor Woody Holton is going to be explaining all this to us, but Abigail Adams was an investing badass, like just a total badass.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, and we've got all that today. But you know what else we got? We got RX Bar helping us out today. I saw you just finished your RX Bar.
I say they're delicious.
I have one after my runs, and healthy portfolio means you got to have a healthy body, right?
Indeed.
Thanks to RX Bar for supporting Stacking Benjamins. RX Bar is a whole food protein bar with no BS. Get 25% off your first order at rxbar.com/SB and use the promo code SB. That's rxbar.com/SB, promo code SB. And big thanks to our friends over at M1 Finance, Brian Barnes and Company, for supporting Stacking Benjamins. You know, guys, according to a 2016 Gallup poll, about 48% of all Americans don't own any stocks, and maybe fewer people own stocks today than own stocks last week.
Yeah, right.
But still, it's incredibly troubling. Well, M1's out to change that trend and help everybody be invested. The tremendous thing about M1 is it really grows with you as your needs change over time. Give it a try. Check out M1 Finance today. You can find it on the web at StackyBenjamins.com/M1Finance, or download their mobile app on iOS or Android. M1 Finance, be invested. We're invested in Abigail Adams on this here show. We got Jamie Wise also coming down to the basement to talk about the social media buzz, but we got a headline first, so let's move.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamins headlines.
Our first headline is apropos, given what happened in the stock market last week. A little jittery, OG.
Down, up, down.
This comes to us from USA Today. Will the stock market crash? Yes. Here's what to do now. This is written by Diana Yoakum. One minute, all economic indicators sitting pretty and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is hitting record highs. The next, blammo, we're in the throes of a stock market sell-off or right-sizing or whatever you want to call it. Semantics is probably the last thing in anybody's mind when you're watching chunks of your 401k and IRA evaporate. People definitely felt this way late last week, OG.
I love the flowery language, but okay.
Yes.
I'm watching it evaporate.
Just as it did recently, stock market's going to decline again, but no one has the luxury of getting a calendar notice announcing the time and magnitude. So what do you do? This is to prevent a knee-jerk reaction during periods of stock market volatility. Follow these tips. I thought we'd run these tips by our resident expert, OG, and see what you think. Number one, trust in diversification. When a market decline hits, your results may vary, perhaps for the better, if you've invested money across different baskets of asset classes.
Love it. Yep, that's true. If everything goes up or down at the same time, you are not diversified.
Right, which is funny because when clients would come into my office to see if we've hit our benchmarks and if the plan's going the way we want, part of that is a portfolio review. I didn't make that a big part because we can't do a lot about the stock market, but we'd look at all the funds and Mike...
Oh, this one's gone down a whole bunch. We should get rid of it.
Yes, at every time. And then we'd have to re-explain that, no, we don't want them all going up at the same time.
Well, diversification, when it does what you're talking about there, when some things underperform or some things overperform, you know, an average, it's got a built-in dollar cost averaging strategy, even if you're not adding money, right? Because now you've got this portion of your account that's done really well, and you've got a portion account that hasn't done as well. Then you can just sell off some of the profit and add to the thing that's done a little less well. It's a nice way of saying it. And you're buying buckets and of stuff on sale.
You know, the question on everybody's mind though, right now, as you're saying this is, okay, I've got this thing that's supposedly on sale. How do I know that it's not just a crappy fund?
Well, that's a great question. If you're like most new investors, and certainly the data supports that new money from new investors is going into indexes and ETFs, then you're not comparing yourself to anything, right? If you want to buy an S&P 500 fund, you go buy an S&P 500 fund and that's your fund. It's by definition, it's not crappy. It is what it is.
It is mediocre.
Yeah, it is average.
Yes.
Minus of cost of some kind. So, you know, you don't have to really worry about that. If you've got active fund management, you know, maybe in your 401k, right? And you don't have options of ETFs or lower cost products in your 401k plan yet. You want to compare it against its peers. And that's the biggest thing. People look at a fund and say, well, this one's down 20% and this one is up 10. So that must mean the down 20 is the sucky one. But the down 21 might be grouped with all the other wrong funds, right? And you're comparing apples and oranges here. So you want to compare all of the same funds together. And then my rule of thumb was always kind of top 50%. And if you're the top half, you're probably better than average.
And a place to do that?
By definition.
How do people find that information?
Oh, easy. I'm Morningstar. Yep.
Yeah, Morningstar.com. Number two on here, remember your appetite for risk. Basically saying, hey man, if you say you're a risky investor on the way up, it's a two-way street, pal. Just hang on for the down because the back up ride's going to come along with it.
Yeah. This is I think the hardest one for people because especially recently, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years, the stock market's done really well, especially in the United States. So everybody's like, yeah, risk. Of course I could take all the risk. And then you get that, minus 10% week or something like that. And you go, whoa, I want to change my mind. You can't. You can't change your mind in a bear market or a decline. That's the bad time to change. You have to change it when everything's good.
Number three on here, know what you own and why. And this is another one that frustrated me when I was an advisor, was that I had some clients that just didn't want to know. They're like, no, I really don't want to know how my asset allocation works. Yeah, but when things start going down, if you understand, it's like my favorite analogy, I think, OG, was when I first started flying in a plane, I was scared to death. I was afraid every time. And, you know, you'd have those little flaps on the wing start coming down and the plane would start listing off to the right. And I'm sure that the pilot's up front having a heart attack. There's warning bells going boop, boop, boop. The whole plane's going down. Right. Then I started goofing around with a friend of mine on Microsoft Flight Simulator. And I realized there's this whole system, used to be anyway, called VORs. And they're these beacons where planes would planes would fly the system. They'd go to a beacon and then those flaps would come down and they'd turn to the next beacon. Then they'd turn. And it's funny, I went from feeling like, oh my God, we're all going to die every time the plane turned to, okay, we just hit the next beacon. Like I didn't have to know everything, but I knew just enough about it to know that when it got bumpy, I wasn't going to have to worry about it.
Yeah. And you're about 50% right on your analogy too, by the way, but close. What the, but I like it.
Are you saying they are panicking? They are panicking?
Probably.
Yeah, they are. They totally oh, my goodness. We hit one of those beacons on the ground.
What do we do? Turn left now.
Number four, be ready to buy the dip. This is a big one because instead of being a passenger, now you're on the attack, and I really like that.
Well, this is that phrase, right? When somebody calls our office or you hear somebody on Twitter say, how do I react to da-da-da-da-da? Great investors don't react, right? They act. And so if today it is 5% less expensive than it was a week ago, it makes today a good deal. You bought it a week ago at a higher price. Now, that doesn't mean that tomorrow it's not going to be 5% less than today. You can't, nobody knows that. But if you got a little dry powder and you see these 10% swings, that's a good opportunity to deploy a little capital.
Number five then is get a second opinion. Basically, if you're going to panic, if you're going to panic, don't just keep it to yourself. Talk to other people and
say,
hey, what do you think I should do here?
Using your plane analogy, you get nudge the guy next to you and go, we're going down, right? This whole thing?
Probably not. I will link to these on the show notes at stackybenjamins.com. And walking down the stairs, our social media correspondent, the one and only Jamie Wise is back. How are you, man?
I'm good. Can you hear me walking down the stairs? I'm trying to bang it down. Yes, it's great to be here back in the basement with you, Joe. How are you?
Well, I'm great. And by the way, people have wondered when the market starts to get bumpy, right? We have said before that there's a place for active investing and that the world of active investing is changing. Talking to people like you and Phil Back about this on many occasions. How has it been? The market has clearly gotten choppy, Jamie. What have we seen from these, from you guys?
There's an old expression that many investors are aware of. Careful what you wish for, right? Jeez, I wish things would just sell off or vol would pick up and give me an opportunity. But we were there putting our hands up saying, bring it on, because we know it's important with especially a new technology and using some artificial intelligence insights to help us choose stocks. We need that to be proven across different market environments, and we just haven't had that since we've launched over the last 2 years. February really gave Buzz a chance to prove its value in volatile markets, and wow, did we experience some volatility last month, and Buzz continued its streak of outperformance, I'm happy to report. So it's doing exactly what we expected it to do. Those stocks that exhibit the best investor sentiment have the most built-up, pent-up demand behind them. They should be cushioned in those types of environments. Why? Because it gives people an opportunity to add to their positions. They're not going to fall as much as the market. And certainly in February, we saw that where Buzz was able to outperform even in a down market, beating the S&P by 2.5% in February alone.
Yeah, the market down roughly 3.5%. The S&P 500, that is, down about 3.5%. You guys down roughly 1%?
That's right.
Yeah. Year to date, as we record this, we're recording this a little early, but the year to date numbers are eye popping. Give me those.
Yeah. So, you know, year to date, really, as we're recording, it is 10.5% for Buzz through to the end of February. So we'll use our month end benchmarks. Buzz up almost 8.5% year to date. And that compares to the S&P, which is up, but just less than 2%. So beating the S&P through February by over 6.5%, better than 7.5% on a year to date basis through time of this recording. So all things going in the right direction.
Well, you're here to talk to us about the wisdom of the crowds, and that's what you guys do. Let's talk about the wisdom. What was the crowd talking about that the S&P 500 missed?
Yeah, you know what? When you see volatility, certainly you see an increase in activity straight across the board, whether that's trading activity and, from our perspective, discussion and engagement across online platforms. So we really noticed not only an increase in discussion, but changing sentiments where people really became vocal about the stocks that they liked in these volatile environments, the ones they were looking to add. And for us, maybe surprisingly, maybe not, it was the tech sector, right? It was the larger tech names that we're familiar with. Some of the smaller names, which have really contributed well to Buzz, we'll call Square and Micron smaller names, even though right. Still large cap equities, but right. Small compared to Google or Apple, let's sure. Say. But sentiment really notably increased amidst all that volatility. To us, we saw that as a really strong bullish indicator, right? This was not the end of the bull market. there was still real strong pent-up demand for these securities. And overall, the community really saw this as an opportunity to get into these stocks. They did. And wow, have they performed since then.
Square is an interesting name because, as you see, the face of retail change, and we've seen job numbers come out, and it looks like big companies did better than small companies. Yet Square is doing this interesting thing, Jamie, which is helping these small retailers kind of stay in business.
Yeah, what an interesting company this is. And it's not just the retailers. It's also, you know, directly to the consumers.
Right,
Square has a really much more diversified business model than most people think, right? We all think of Square as that little dongle at the end of, you know, some retailer's phone. And it's how easy is that to swipe your credit card through? Great product. But it's more than a one-trick pony. They do direct lending. They're really starting to compete directly with banks, right? They're allowing consumers to take direct cash deposits into their accounts. People are trying to figure out, what kind of company will Square become? Is it a bank at the end of the day? Is it just a payment processing company? Is it a lending company? Whatever it is, it's certainly firing on all cylinders across all of those verticals, and people are catching on, and the stocks and shareholders are being rewarded for it.
Are you seeing any play lately with all of the tariff talk? I mean, lately, not just the president, of course, talking tariffs, but also Elon Musk jumping on that train on one end, lots of people on the other side, of course, and you don't know what's politics, what's real. What are we seeing the crowd say about tariffs and maybe some of these steel companies?
It's a great question, Joe. I'm glad you asked it, because it's exactly why our approach to sentiment is important here. These tariffs have been in the news. There's a lot of volatility, a lot of really short-term sentiment that you can find from that, but it's not changing longer-term perceptions. And that's what we're really focused on here in Buzz, is capturing those longer-term trends. And you see it, and we've talked about this before with you, this idea of diminishing returns of influence, right? So Donald Trump, when he talks about tariffs, it gets a reaction instantly in the market. That's very short-term sentiment, but that fades very quickly because, let's be fair, he talks about a lot of things, and it takes time for those things to, you know, translate through. Will they actually happen? Do we believe what he is saying will be as meaningful as he indicates when he says it, right? And I think people look through that now a little bit faster than they did the first time he talked about General Motors or Boeing, you know, before he was – right when he was elected, right, you know, right around that time. So – and if it's sure enough, you know, he talks about these tariffs, but then when they go through – they're really softened down, right? Like,
right.
They're not going to apply to Canada, for example. Well, we have a pretty good trading relationship with steel. I'm Canadian, of course, right? So, you know, how meaningful will these tariffs be? Is this really a strong protectionist policy, as he first indicated in that first, you know, press conference or tweet or however he decides to communicate these things? That diminishing return of influence, the crowd sees through it. We learn quickly. We're all intelligent individuals. Collectively, we really get the insight. I don't think right now we're not seeing longer term changes in sentiment that will make meaningful changes to, you know, U.S. steel or other producers, domestic producers within the portfolio. But we'll see.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to go to this space in general before we have to say goodbye, which is when we look at the S&P versus other active funds, it looks like everybody's up. They're not up as much as you are, but it looks like, you know, this idea that active management's changing, Jamie, it's kind of working across the face of the kind of AI-driven active management community.
Sure. You know, we were, I think, first out there in the marketplace showing and attempting to show people that there can really be value in using insights from AI-based processes to source securities for your portfolio, and that over time those things should outperform. Well, we knew we weren't going to be the only one forever, and there's been a couple other funds that have launched in the last year. So there's AIEQ, that's the ticker symbol for an ETF that uses IBM's Watson as its AI to choose stocks. And there's one up here in Canada called, the ticker symbol is MIND, and they also have developed their own proprietary AI, and that AI chooses stocks to invest in. And sure, they're up on a year-to-date basis, you know, right through the time we're talking here. MIND is up 2%, AIEQ is up 4.5%. So they are showing that they can, you know, keep up with that S&P return for the year. AIEQ doing a little bit better, but neither of them keeping up to the 10.5% of Buzz. Why is that? So, and this is important. We've talked about this, right? We know that AI models, just like human beings, just like star portfolio managers, although AI can handle a lot more data than any human being or any one star portfolio manager, they need time to learn and adapt, right? And we've had that 2-year head start. So as we see more data, as we're able to pull more data into our models, as people across online platforms talk more and more about what they're doing in their investment portfolio, that gives us a richer data set to extract insight from and allows us, puts us in a position to then pick the best from that expanded data set. And I think that's really what's been contributing to the outperformance.
Yeah, well, it's really exciting to see. I love this whole idea, as you know, of AI-driven active management, but also great to see you guys just killing it against, you know, what clearly some people would see as the competition. I think there's probably room for all of you, but you guys are just smoking them. So a couple quick things before we leave. If you want more about the Buzz Index, head to stackybenjamins.com/BUZZ, and that will tell you more about the index. It trades under ticker symbol BUZ. And just a disclaimer for everybody, in my wife and my spouse Cheryl's portfolio, we both own the Buzz Index. So I have to tell you that, obviously, right for us, but doesn't make it right for you. Jamie Wise, thanks a ton for hanging out with us again today, man.
Great being back here with you, Joe. Look forward to catching up very soon.
Thanks a ton again to Jamie for coming down to the basement. Hey, I think our lesson, obviously, we got plenty of lessons from Jamie, but our lessons with last week's stock market gets bumpy, OG. Don't panic. Go on the attack, man.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Don't do that.
Yeah, you got the wrong lesson. I'm about to call up Dr. Woody Holton on My Dad's Shortwave. He is the foremost expert in Abigail Adams. And it's funny, when I talked to a friend of mine, Liz Covert, who's been on this show, she's a historian in Boston, who runs an excellent podcast called Ben Franklin's World. Whenever I see her at podcasting conferences, we always talk about we're the Ben Franklin podcasters, you and Liz and I, OG. So I was talking to her about Abigail Adams, and she's like, well, I'd love to talk to you about her, but I know the guy who is the person, and he's incredible. He was the 2000 Merrill Curdy Award winner from the Organization of American Historians for his book, Forced Founders. In 2007, he was a National Book Award finalist for his book, Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution. In 2008, he scored the Guggenheim Fellowship for those, quote, who have demonstrated exceptional capacity for productive scholarship or exceptional creative ability in the arts. And of course, the big boy, in 2010, he won the Bancroft Prize, which is awarded to historians for his excellent work on Abigail Adams. And we're about to talk to him about Mrs. Adams on the shortwave. Let's say hello to Dr. Woody Holton. And on My Dad's Shortwave, it's Dr. Woody Holton. Glad you could join us today.
Yeah, really great to talk to you, Jeff.
How did you first become acquainted with Abigail Adams? I mean, as the guy who wrote the book, Abigail Adams, when did your thirst for finding out about Abigail Adams begin?
I was doing another book on a totally different topic, on the role of bond speculators in bringing about the U.S. Constitution. Long story short, I needed one of these guys. It can be a really boring topic for people, bond speculators. So I was trying to find one of these guys who was really well documented so I could use him to kind of put a face on all the others. And there weren't enough things about this guy. I mean, this guy, maybe I had letters, but no financial account. And then I found one of these really shrewd bond speculators who really was well documented, and it turned out to be Abigail Adams. She, during the Revolutionary War, bought up all of these government bonds at a fraction of their face value and eventually was able to redeem them at pretty close to face value, and she made a killing off the Revolutionary War.
There couldn't have been that many women investors at the time.
Well, interesting point. If you go to Britain, you would see lots of women investors because, you know, your husband dies and he leaves you a bunch of property and you don't want to, for instance, he's a slave merchant or something like that, and you don't want to be involved in a business that you may not know very well. So you might buy British government bonds, which, like our U.S. government bonds today, nice, safe investments. You might make 4% a year. But what Abigail Adams was doing was something completely different, which is the word speculator. You could use the term junk bond trader. She's betting on bonds that might end up worthless, but if the If her ship comes in, she's going to make a huge windfall, and that's what happened.
Would that be a correlation today to like someone investing in Bitcoin?
Yes, to the extent that I understand Bitcoin, which is not very much. Yes. And it went up and down as Bitcoin did. For instance, in response to U.S. government bonds were very low at the end of 1776 as General Gordon Wallace sort of shooed General Washington and his army across New Jersey. And literally one of the reasons that Washington crossed the Delaware on Christmas night, December 25th, 1776, and attacked Trenton, New Jersey, one of his motivations for doing that was to raise the value of U.S. government bonds. Obviously, he also wanted to restore the morale of the soldiers, and particularly for the non-soldiers. That is, he wanted to convince other people to enlist in the Continental Army, and people got to believe you're going to win before they'll enlist. But he also was trying to enlist investors to get people to buy U.S. government bonds. And that was a huge part of his motivation for attacking the Hessians at Trenton, which he did successfully, another famous story of Washington crossing the Delaware.
It's funny how there's always another motivation that people have never heard about. And I love the fact that bonds were a part of that move on that particular day. How did Abigail Adams become such a savvy investor? Is it something in her education and her upbringing? Was it the people she hung out with?
Yes and yes. But I'd say the big thing in her upbringing, and I think it's, by the way, what also attracted John Adams to her back in the 1760s when they were courting, was that she had an amazing self-confidence. Now, if you read her letters, she'll go through the motions of the false modesty. And she was insecure about the fact that she'd had very little formal education, although she was always quick to point out there was a reason for that, and that was that she was female. But she was a very well-educated person, even if you don't consider the fact that she didn't get much formal schooling, because she was self-educated. She had all these women friends that would write letters to each other, and they educated each other about Shakespeare and about classical history. She even knew something about the Quran. So she had we all know there's practical benefits of education, but one of the side benefits is that self-confidence. And so I'd say the biggest thing that came out of her upbringing was her self-confidence. And then, yes, she did have advisors who kind of got her started, an uncle in particular, a doctor for whom Tufts University is named Cotton Tufts. And so he advised her. But I got to tell you, that's at the start of the Revolutionary War, 1777 and 8, the early years. He's advising her by the 1780s after the war, when the bonds are still really fluctuating, which they continued to do until the Constitution. By the 1780s, this guy who had been her advisor, she was advising him.
Really? Wow. Yeah. And was it mostly just bonds, or was she a diversified investor as well?
It became mostly bonds, although by the 19th century, you know, she died in 1818. By that time, she was into canals and bank stock and things like that. But bonds were definitely not the first thing. The very first way that she really helped her family financially, and let me say, compare John Adams to the next couple of presidents, these two Virginians, James Madison, first Thomas Jefferson and then James Madison. Both Jefferson and Madison died so deep in debt that their beautiful family estate, Monticello, and then for Madison, Montpelier, had to be sold just to pay off their debts. Contrast that to John Adams, who died rich and debt-free. And the single biggest reason he did that was Abigail Adams's investments. So her first investment came out of a tragic aspect of her life. That's how she saw it. And that was that John got sent to France as an American, basically ambassador, didn't use the term. And she said, well, look, you're going to be sending me letters. Why don't you also send me merchandise from France? Because then, as now, a lot of Americans were excited about French fashions. But unlike now, there was a British blockade. And so a large percentage of the ships sent over from France to America were captured by the British. And of course, that made the few things that got through incredibly valuable. At one point, when John had started sending her stuff, you know, a couple of their shipments got captured by the British, totally lost. And he said, you know, maybe we should give this up. And she goes, no, if one in three arrives, I should be a gainer, which I take to be the 18th century version of you just don't get it, do you, John? The whole point is it's a risky business, and because of the high risk, it's high rewards too.
Well, that's what I was going to ask next, is if she and John agreed on their investment philosophies. Were they similar?
No. This was one of my favorite discoveries researching her, was that if you watch, there's an HBO movie about John Adams, which is really good, but it kind of portrays her as the calming influence and John as, you know, he's played by Paul Giamatti with those bug eyes, all excited. And she's, you know, she's like June Cleaver, you know, massaging his shoulders. Calm down, John. The opposite was true, both on the emotional level. Everybody that John Adams hated, and he hated just about everybody at some point, you know, Jefferson, Hamilton, everybody but Washington, basically. He was jealous of Washington. Everybody that Benjamin Franklin, Hancock, everybody that John Adams hated, Abigail hated more. That carried over into the financial world, where he was an incredibly conservative investor. So at one point, he had some money coming to him, and he wrote this. At this point, he and she were both over in France. So he wrote a letter to the guy who's handling his affairs back in Massachusetts, saying, hey, I got some money coming to me, and I've always wanted to buy Vesey's farm, which is near mine. And a couple of days later, she wrote that same financial agent, her husband's financial agent, saying, well, you know what? Man, let's hold off on buying Vesey's farm. And eventually gets another letter from John where he starts the letter saying, buy Vesey's farm. Hey, I told you to buy Vesey's farm. In the letter, here's what he says. Shewing what I have written to madam, she has made me sick with Vesey's place. You will therefore, and then buy more bonds. She had convinced him in the middle of his writing that letter to switch from his favorite investment, which was in land, to her favorite investment, which was in bonds. The reason he liked land, you may remember from Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara's father says, land, Scarlett, that's the one thing worth fighting for and dying for. It's the one thing that the enemy can't burn. They can burn your house. They can take all your property, but they can't take your land. And so, you know, we think of that as sort of a Southern thing, this desire to be a feudal lord with your land. But John, although a classic New Englander in every other respect, he was a very conservative investor and believed that land gave him economic independence, which made him a person who couldn't be blackmailed, a person who couldn't be bribed, and so forth. It was part of the whole Republican ideal of the 18th century, small r Republican. So it was kind of a political thing for him, a cultural thing for him, but most of all, it's just a safe thing to do. And Abigail would say to him, well, that's all well and good, but you're making 1% a year annual return, and I can make you 20.
It's so funny that she's I don't know, it's reading everything you've written about her, it seems like she's somewhat of a pot stirrer. But also, when it comes to the law at the time, you mentioned in some of your writing that they had, and you mentioned earlier that they have this advisor and these people that are supposed to be selling land for them. Legally, it sounds like, tell me if I have this right, they weren't allowed to, when she stepped in and said, no, don't follow John's advice, do what I tell you to do. Legally, they weren't supposed to do that, were they?
You talk about women, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is my favorite part of the Abigail story. And let me set up a little bit by saying, I kind of went back and forth on her because these bonds that she's dealing in had been paid out to the soldiers who actually fought and won the Revolutionary War and made all those sacrifices, like crossing the Delaware on Christmas night when it was 33 degrees in a nor'easter with snow flashing at their faces and all that. Washington couldn't pay those guys real money, so he gave them basically IOUs. You can't eat a paper, so you got to sell it. You sell it at a fraction of its face value, and then it trades around. So it's kind of an unscrupulous business to be in. And when I studied that aspect of Abigail Adams, yeah, I didn't like her. But then I made what for me was an amazing discovery, and that is the will that she wrote in 1816 when she thought she was dying. She actually lived two more years. But the key fact about that will is that John Adams was still alive. That is, she was a married woman. And married women, in the eyes of the law, this is British, English common law, but the Americans retained it even after they declared independence. English common law says to you, if you're a woman, the minute you get married, you are basically dead in the eyes of the law. You're covered. They call it coverture because you're covered by your husband. So you could own a massive amount of personal property, and the second you get married, it all goes to you. So bonds would be an example of that. Livestock would be another. And so when she wrote this will, she's giving away all this stuff that technically she didn't own. But over the decades, she had amassed, she'd taken some of this money that she had made for John. She made a ton for John, but she took some of it and she started referring to it. And I love this phrase, this money, which I call mine. So she knew that a smart lawyer like John Adams or even a not so smart lawyer could take it all away from her in a second because she's a married woman. Married women aren't supposed to own personal property, but she did it anyway. And she used it for at one point, my favorite letter that she ever wrote John, he was in Europe. She's trying to get him to come home. She called herself a widow, tired of being a widow. She wanted her husband back. He was still trying to buy that Vese farm I talked about a minute ago. And she said, look, you don't have the money in your account, but I know where I can borrow you some money to buy that farm. And I'll only do that if you'll come home. And guess where she was going to borrow that money from herself. So she's basically trying to bribe her husband to come home. And she's bribing him with what, in the eyes of the law, was his own money. But here's one of the coolest things you can say about John Adams. And that is, by this time, he had accepted this notion of hers. He'd been totally dismissive of her open statements about women's rights. But within the family, he respected her so much. And that's because she demanded it. He respected her so much that he accepted this idea that there was this property that technically is not hers, but in every sense it was. She could use it to bribe him. She used it to bribe one of her sons to move home. At one point, she loved having her family around her, as we all do. And so she used it in all these ways. And then she writes this will. And when John found that will in her papers after her death, he would have been completely within his rights to just rip it up and throw it in the fire. What he actually did was comply with it to the letter. And that's neat that John Adams respected his wife so much, but it also transformed it into a legally binding document. Because in the eyes of the law, all of that dispositional property, as she called it, was her acting as his agent.
That's so awesome. And I think that's a great place to leave our discussion of Abigail Adams today. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about two other things. One is, of course, you wrote the book Abigail Adams in 2010. How exciting was it when you found out you'd won the Bancroft Prize?
It was amazing. I was at my university at the time. I was teaching, I'm now at the University of South Carolina, but I was then at Richmond and had terrible cell service. And I got this message, something about the librarian at Columbia University. And I went, oh my gosh, do I have books checked out from there? Am I in trouble? But they're the ones who run the Bancroft, so it turned out pretty well.
That's fantastic. And then the second thing is, you told me earlier before we started recording that you're working on something new. Are you able to talk about what that project is?
Sure. Thank you for letting me plug it. I'm doing a overall history of the American Revolution in which I try to integrate the social history and the history of the 99% Native Americans, women, African-Americans, with the traditional political history like Washington, crossing the Delaware and Yorktown and things like that. My angle is to be the first person to really, lots of people have written about all of them, but you tend to have a chapter on Native Americans and chapter on African-Americans and so forth. And I'm really trying to integrate everybody into the same unitary narrative. So an integrated history or a whole grained history is what I'm trying to write. And she will certainly play a big role in it.
That's so exciting. We'd love to have you back when you're ready to talk more about that. Dr. Woody Holton, thank you for joining us for a few minutes for Women's History Month. We really appreciate it.
Sure. I'll take you up on that invite, Joe. Thanks a lot.
Hey there, trivia fan. I'm Douglas, the Trivia Man, and I'm swooping in here to save your mediocre day with a healthy and mind-bending dollop of my most excellent factification. Yes, it's a word. You don't need to go look it up. As part of my National Spinach Day celebration, Joe's mom suggested that it makes sense to talk about Popeye. Remember him? He's the spinach-eating cartoon character dude who grew some serious guns. Well, you know, nearly as big as these babies, but oh, he did it all by eating spinach. You probably can fill in the blanks. Anyways, he had some friends who also appeared with him, and that's where we'll focus today's trivia question, which is this. What day would Popeye's friend Wimpy pay you for a hamburger if you gave him one today? I'll be back with the answer in just a moment.
Thanks to RX Bar for supporting Stacking Benjamins. I like RX Bars after my morning run. What I like about them is they're a whole food protein bar made with 100% whole ingredients and no BS like added sugar, artificial color, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. They're made with a few simple, clean ingredients where every ingredient serves a purpose. For example, egg whites, their main source of protein. It's easy for your body to absorb. They're gluten-free, they're soy-free, they're dairy-free. No artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. They come in 11 delicious flavor varieties. RX bars are either sweet or savory, chocolate, fruit flavors. There's an RX bar for you. I'm personally partial to the chocolate, but that's just me. Real food ingredients actually taste really good, and you can actually taste the cocoa, the real fruit, and the spices like sea salt. They're ideal for breakfast on the go, snack at the office, throw in your bag for the plane ride, toss in your backpack for a bike ride or a hike, or a pre, or the way I like my RX bar, as a post-workout snack. Head to rxbar.com/SB and use the promo code SB. And guess what? Because you're a Stacking Benjamins fan and you work out and then have RX bars, you'll get 25% off. That's rxbar.com/SB. Promo code SB. It's 25% off. Thanks again to RX Bar for supporting Stacking Benjamins. Hey, Stackers, I'm sure you know by now that both my spouse Cheryl and I use M1 Finance for our personal investments. That doesn't make it right for you. You should do your own homework. We'll call that our disclaimer here up top. But recently, we've had exciting news from the team at M1 Finance. They've announced they're now a completely free-to-use investing platform. You heard that right. No fees, no commissions outside of the investments themselves. I sat down with Brian Barnes, CEO and founder, and asked what made him decide to make M1 Finance free.
We believe in the future, all investing platforms will be free. So it was a decision to get ahead of the curve. It's obviously beneficial for the customer who will save money and be able to invest more. For M1, we have other sources of revenue, which were greater than the fee we charge. So the more people using M1, the better for us as well.
So how about that? No fees, no commissions, just you with more money to save and in control of your portfolio. They'll even invest fractional shares for you. You take the wheel or have them invest in a professionally managed approach like some of the robo companies out there. It takes only a minute to sign up. Start by heading over to stackingbenjamins.com/M1Finance. M1 Finance, be invested.
Hey there, trivia nerds. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, with an announcement. Apparently, rubbing this spinach stuff on your arms doesn't make them bigger. Or does it have to sit overnight? I bet that's it. I'm just going to have to let it sit here overnight. I'll take out the good old Wikipedia in a moment, but let's get your answer to today's trivia question, which was this. In Popeye's cartoons, his friend Wimpy would pay you on a certain day if you gave him a hamburger today. What day was that? Tuesday! And if you got it right, pay yourself a compliment and maybe give yourself a spinach rubdown. It feels pretty darn good. See ya!
What if it is Tuesday? I always wondered that. I'm like, but what if it's Tuesday right now? Then what do you tell Wimpy? Well, you're going to pay me right now for the hamburger?
I like how they kind of adapted that joke in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, it's fun. I didn't see Good Will Hunting.
No. Shut the front door.
I really didn't.
You've never seen it.
Oh, boy. Here comes the mail.
Oh, my gosh. Mr. I've got a movie pass, and I see all the Oscar nominees, but not the winners. I don't do necessarily the winners.
That was back beforehand, Mr. Salt in the Wound. Check you out. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline and tackle some of life's, or rather life insurance's, most important questions. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency are disrupting the life insurance industry by focusing on those two things, OG, you value most.
Market declines and spinach, I guess. I don't know.
Bam. Or your family and your time, whichever, you know. It's why they created a simple way to buy affordable and dependable term life insurance online. Head to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life now to get a free estimate for coverage and to learn about life insurance the modern way. stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life, where now they go up to $2 million.
Easy peasy.
How about that? Let's say hello. Let's say hello today. We're going to throw out the lifeline to our friend Nelson. Say hi, Nelson.
Hey, Joe and OG. This is Nelson calling from UNC, who unfortunately did about as well as the Spartans here in March Madness.
Glorious.
So I was calling about how to talk to my dad about changing my parents' financial advisor. They started talking to me more about money as I've gotten older, and I recently found out that their financial advisor is also their insurance broker, so I'm pretty sure you can see where this is going. So I just need to know how to respectfully have that conversation and point them more in a path that's going to be more beneficial for them. Thanks and love the show. Bye.
So OG, great question. You know, I'm not sure that I'm worried that much about, I mean, don't get me wrong. I tend to like people that are fee first or fee only advisors, but we don't know that this, this insurance person's necessarily horrible.
I've got a couple of words for you, Nelson. Mind your own darn business. You know, here's the deal, man. You're a kid. You might not be a kid. You might be a 50-year-old man, but you're still your parents' kid, right? You've got to think about the dynamics of the parent-child relationship. I have an uncle who I love dearly. Just the greatest person on earth, right? And I remember asking him one time about why he chose to use a friend of mine as his investment advisor at a substandard organization, in my humble opinion. And he said very plainly, "Oh, gee, it's because I remember changing your diapers." You know what I mean?
You're the wrong messenger, is what you're saying.
Yeah. You know, I think you mind your own business. And if it comes up in conversation,
I don't know though. My parents, it sounds like Nelson's parents have been talking to him about their financial plan. I mean,
if they have been, then that gives you the opportunity to add some color to the conversation, I suppose. But the tough part about involving yourself in the middle of a relationship, because that's pretty much what you're doing, right? You don't, maybe these guys have been working, mom and dad have been working with this guy for 30 years, right? You're still a kid. I mean, you might be 40 years old, but you're still a kid. You know what I mean? That's kind of why I asked about the whole, like, you know, do you have kids, right?
Well, that's why if I have any thought about this at all, my thought is not about the advisor. It's about the advice, right? Because we get in our head that an advisor is good or bad. And I have friends that were commission-based advisors. I wouldn't go search for a commission-only advisor if I'm looking for a new, I wouldn't do it. But I do have friends who were commission-only advisor that I would send mom to. I would send mom to them in a hurry because they're the most trustworthy people. And by the way, I know fee-only advisors who are the biggest losers on earth that I wouldn't trust in a million years.
It's not the umbrella that you're under that matters, right? It's the quality of the advice that you're getting or giving.
Right. It's a good marker to go with somebody who's going to charge fees versus commissions, because we all generally, where our bread's buttered, that's where we're, you know, it's going to be easier for a commission person to maybe do the wrong thing. However, in this case, like you're talking about with Nelson, we don't know the advisor. But if the advice isn't good, so I wouldn't go after the advisor, Nelson. I would, if you and your dad are having conversations about the advice and the advice they're getting from the advisor is not good, I might then say, "Oh, you know what? I heard this other thing," like very casually. "Oh, I read in this respectable place that this other thing is something that's probably better." Or, "Have you seen the fees on those things?" I might, and then maybe start poking holes in the advice. But we don't know any of that.
Yeah, it's really difficult to like I said, insert yourself into that. And I think the best way is, if you're going to do it, is kind of like what you said, which is if it comes up, you've got to have some ammunition around the advice component, not, you know, Bob is an idiot because he works at ABC company, or Bob is probably screwing you because he works at ABC company. You know, it's still very difficult though, because you don't know the whole deal. You don't know.
Well, he might, Nelson might, but yeah. He didn't give us any clues.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's about the advice, not the advisor.
Okay. Good luck and mind your business.
We also get mail down here in the basement, and Doug just brought this letter down from our new friend, Mike. Mike says, you guys are great. Love your bit on Doug's show. I love how Doug gets ownership on the show. I was listening to your show dated January 23rd, the one with Clark Howard. Thomas had a question near the end of the show and asked about the benefits of converting a Roth 457 to a Roth IRA. Sounds like OG nailed the creditor protection piece. I had another thought as well, which you may like to confirm, given that I'm just a bonehead firefighter. I have a 457 plan as a city employee. I'm also doing the 457 Roth. The potential downside to this is that the 457 Roth is subject to required minimum distributions, whereas the Roth IRA is not. Thomas may want to make sure he takes advantage of the protection of the 457 for as long as he can, but ensure that he completes the trustee-to-trustee transfer before he's impacted with the required minimum distributions that govern the 457 plan. Thanks, you guys may not be the best, but you're far from the worst. Mike from Tacoma.
Nerd alert.
I know.
Been reading some IRS code in their free time.
That's pretty good, though. I mean, a lot of the time, we don't hit every nail, but we're kind of moving fast. And I think...
Swing in the dark, mostly. But
I think Mike brings up another good point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. Required distributions, most people just tag to IRAs and, you know, regular 401k plans and think about them from the tax impact of them, right? So I got to take money out of my IRA even if I don't need it, and I got to pay this tax. But another aspect of the required distribution rule is being forced to take tax-free money out when you don't really want it, because the idea of a Roth plan, of course, is that that money is never going to be taxed for 1,000 generations. So why would you want to distribute it? You would want that to be like the last dollar you use, so in case you can kick it to the next generation, you can. Now, of course, the next generation gets the money, they do have a required distribution.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I think that the longer you delay that, the better.
Good stuff. Thanks for the note, Mike. If you've got a question for the show, or you want to chime in like Mike did, head to stackingbenjamins.com. And at the top of the page, you'll see the questions for the show link. Click that link and you'll see all the ways you can get a hold of us. I also, OG, I don't say thank you nearly enough. And got to say some thank yous to, and I'm going to miss people because people have done some very nice things for us. But first of all, our friend Jen Hemphill from the Her Money Matters podcast had a new book, and we had her on because she's great radio. But look at what she sent us as a thank you. She sent this this cover art from the show that we can hang in the basement.
Sexy looking guy with the bag on his head.
How about that? Yeah. So thanks to Jen. Also thanks to David. And David did something huge. He sent us beer.
Oddly enough, it seems to be already gone.
Richie and I made good use of the beer, and they were three different beers, and just some great stuff. First one was this Crux Pils, which was awfully good beer. Comes from Bend, Oregon. These are all Oregon beers. Second one, I love this one, the Abominable Winter Ale, pretty hoppy ale. That one comes from Hopworks Urban Brewery. And then the third one from Hop Valley, the Light Me Up Lager. So I love these names, and I'm just a sucker for packaging. So big thanks to David for helping us stay lubricated here in the basement. Also, thanks to the Puglisi's. Vincent Puglisi, of course, was on the show. He sent a great picture of us when they came through town, which was really neat. Went out to dinner with us, and that was fantastic. And a little game, OG, which was this knot tying game. Nothing we like better than tying ourselves in knots. And then fourth, I just got a note from Nick, who's made a Stacking Benjamins card game that he's sending to us. So I can't wait to see that. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to everybody who's listened to the show. Oh, gee, thanks to you for another great show. Thanks, of course, and Doug's going to thank him too. But thanks again to Woody Holden. Abigail Adams, OG, financial badass.
Founding mother.
It's so great. All right, Doug, what should we have learned today?
Now, Joe, kale won't work. And no, you don't put it there. What are you doing? Oh, my God. All right. Hey, everybody. What should you have learned today in between all this bizarre vegetable spinach trivia we've been talking about? First, take some advice from Abigail Adams. We don't get to say that very often. Instead of investing in the safe option, dig into your goals, build some investment savvy, and take the reins. Second, a stock market drop? Sure, it'll drop more, but if you're thinking about your plan instead of the market, you'll stay in control and avoid the panic selling that these markets create in the first place. But the big lesson? Don't rub yourself down with spinach to grow bigger muscles. Apparently, you gotta burn the spinach and then read the charred leaves for clues. Something like that. I don't know. Special thanks to Dr. Woody Holton for joining us today. You'll find his book, Abigail Adams, wherever books are sold. When you're done messing around with us, who do you want to teach you some money tricks? That nerd who talks over your head or your favorite basement-based geeks? Kathleen Selmans operates our Stacking Benjamins classroom, and to make up for the fact that we don't teach you anything here on the show, she's created a whole lot of tools you'll absolutely love. Head to learn.stackingbenjamins.com for details. And use coupon code DOUGROCKS for 10% off. Yeah, you're welcome. This show was created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. Shannon Cowan is our community manager and social media guru. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and there's a 73% chance that I played Chuck on Happy Days. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. There's no way you would take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor. Thanks to Joe's mom for celebrating National Spinach Day with me. You know where you go to hang out and celebrate Spinach Day? The Salad Bar. Yeah, I'll meet y'all there.
Welcome to the after show. You know, I got this note from Lori. Lori said, "Hey, Joe, I heard the episode about your coleslaw story. I'm sorry. Sorry to hear you got so sick. For people that missed that, I chowed on some coleslaw that had been sitting out for about 8.5 hours. And I found out that I'm a little harder to kill off than I thought. Because even though for three...
But they made a valiant effort.
I made a very good effort of trying to kill myself. She said, in college, I took a class we called Baby Bio, which was Biology 101 and 102 for non-science majors. I'll never forget one during the bacteria section of the class. The professor told us never to eat anything with mayo in it at a picnic. He said within 5 minutes of mayo being out of the fridge, bacteria starts growing in it very quickly. I can't imagine the amount of bacteria that was growing in your coleslaw 8 hours after it was first served. for 30 years, I've been avoiding all mayo-doused food at gatherings unless I know it was just put out. That one class has paid for itself many times in non-monetary ways. Well, Lori, you don't get to visit the bathroom as many times as I did, so I've got that. I found all through Southwest Arkansas and Northeast Texas where the restrooms were for a few days, which was nice. And I got to find out what, you know, people talk about chilling in bed. You know, I was shaking with the chills in bed, which might be something a little different.
Yeah, don't do that either.
No, probably not good.
Do not. I like the no mayo idea. That sounds like a good just life guideline.
The mayo's been sitting out. Don't eat it.
I'm going to put that on my things I need to teach my kids.
Apparently, I got to tattoo it to my arm.